I mean, the period when the press was most free was about the mid-19th century. I mean, at that time, just keeping to say England and the United States, the two cases that have been studied, I imagine it's the same elsewhere. In the mid-19th century, there was a very lively, popular press, very widely read by, you know, working people, by everyone, that, you know, much reached far beyond the commercial media at the time. It was very diverse. It represented, you know, it reflected public interest and public concerns, and was very popular. In Britain, they tried to close it down by censorship of various kinds, but that didn't work. There were too many ways to avoid it. And it was finally understood that the way to eliminate it was by advertising, by reliance on advertising and by concentration of capital. So just through the effect of reliance on advertising, which was then just a, you know, kind of beginning, like around a century ago, and concentration of capital, they realized that over time they could marginalize the independent popular press, which couldn't get the advertising, of course, because advertisers don't like what they were saying, didn't have the capital. And it took a long time. So in England, it was actually up until about 40 years ago, still the case 40 years ago, that the main newspaper in England, the Daily Herald, was a kind of labor-oriented social democratic newspaper, very popular. Everybody had outsold all the others. The Mirror, which was the main tabloid, was the same kind of leftist paper, popular paper. But they kind of succumbed to advertising pressure and capital control. The United States happened a bit earlier, but it was the same process. Advertising is, it's part of a much bigger industry. Advertising is part of the public relations industry, which is a huge industry. And it developed very consciously around the First World War in the two most democratic countries, England and the United States. And there's a good reason for it. They were coming to, as the countries were becoming more free, that just through popular struggle and people were winning the franchise and you couldn't shut them up anymore by force, it was understood that you're going to have to control people by controlling opinion and attitudes, because we can't rely on force anymore. And control of opinion and attitudes means, there was actually a phrase for it. This was the time when what was called scientific management of work was becoming a big issue, Taylorite management, you know, Ford and all that stuff. It was also understood you want to not only control very closely the lives of people in their work time, but also you have to control them in their off-work time. And what you have to do is turn them into passive, obedient consumers don't try to get out of our hair, basically. Pay attention to what were called the superficial things of life, like fashionable consumption. You get them trapped into consumerism, isolated from one another, atomized, control their beliefs. That's where notions like manufacture of consent come from right after this First World War. And out of this came huge industries. And advertising is a large part of it, but and it of course affects the media enormously. I mean, if any of you are, you know, if you watch television, for example, take say television. When you turn on the television set, the corporation doesn't make any money, right? Like you don't pay them when you turn it on, unless it's cable. But they do. So why do they do it? Well, they do it because of the advertising. So the resources and the creativity and the effort and so on in the whole television industry goes into advertising. In fact, within the television industry, there are words called content and fill. Like a program has content and a program has fill. The content is the advertising. The fill is the car chase that's in there to keep you watching until the next ad comes along. And all the effort, of course, goes into the advertising. And the fill has first of all, it's to keep your interest enough so you watch the advertising, but the advertising is there for a purpose. I mean, it's to make you, it's to turn people into creatures whose only concern in life is to max out their 5 credit cards and not to pay attention to what's going on in the world and let the rich, powerful guys do what they want without interference. And for the more educated sectors, you know, folks like us, it's to make sure that they have the right beliefs. So therefore, that's the elite media, you know, instill the right beliefs. Actually, that's what universities are for, too. Schools, universities, media. That's not so much advertising control in that case as you know, just the general indoctrination. But the scale of this is incredible. I mean, there's what's called marketing, which is just manipulation and control, and is concerned very specifically with off-job control of people's lives, much like the on-job control in scientific management. It's estimated to be about 1/6 of gross domestic product in the United States, which is maybe $1 or $2 trillion a year. It doesn't contribute to economic efficiency or anything. It contributes to control and domination. That's why, you know, you watch when I watch television with my 2-year-old grandchildren, you know, they're already being inundated by a flood of stuff to buy this and buy that and get your mother to buy you this and so on and so forth. And that's got to be what life's about.
American media is a business, and it has a mission, not to inform Americans, but to entertain them.
You know, there's happy news for happy people with happy problems.
And the business leaders said that they had to renew with vigor what they called the everlasting battle for the minds of men and indoctrinate citizens with a capitalist story.
Global corporations feeding us the news as they see fit.
Truth is subversive. It's anti-American.
Americans have computers in school, dozens of TV stations, and the most aggressive news media on Earth. Does that mean they're better informed? Hardly.
And now, for Newsreel, here's Sean Kennedy.
And it is a good day. The Sean Kennedy Report from the Internet for Monday, March the 8th, 2011. And that's right, you're listening to Newsreel, the WOG Global Sit Rep on core political tyranny, technology, and trends for your headspace and timing. Rant Media is taking a stand for free speech today. And just by listening and distributing this program, you are too. You can follow up on all these news stories, and you can check my facts by going to my live journal. And, of course, you can get to my live journal by going to sean_kennedy.livejournal.com. This is a free podcast still that can be heard on Rant Radio Talk, Red Mercury, SESRN, Wild Bunch Radio, KJAG Radio, Osprey Networks, Creek Radio, iTunes, Podcast.com, Podcast Alley, and every Thursday night we broadcast live in Second Life Node, Archer's Grid 155-74666. And with us tonight, we have Agent Dak Avamoad, Anthony L., by Tebbing Resident, and of course, Xerxes is here, JC Denton, Lachlan Corum, Orps, Napalm, Phoenix, Roshan, Sporadiki, and Tackcraft. So very, very good to see you all here for another live show. Let's not forget, of course, that we have Radio 99 transmitting on a frequency of 6673.3 kilohertz. Sammy is not going to be with us tonight, so unfortunately you're stuck with me coming at you large and in charge. If you downloaded the program, you're going to be noticing that there was a 6-minute clip sent in, and this was sent in by Jory. Fantastic. Here's a 6-minute clip of Noam Chomsky on the freedom of press and advertisement ripped from the film Noam Chomsky on the World, the Chomsky Sessions. He talks about the need of the elite to control the people with advertising in their work and daily life starting around 1900. 30 years later, Edward Bernays, which he doesn't mention in the speech, with the help of his uncle's writings, Sigmund Freud, developed what we know today as public relations / propaganda, and at what advertisements have turned into an appalling use of psyops and emotional leverage to sell people shit they don't really need. Bernays found that if you can appeal to people's underlying emotions, you can sell them stuff. This is covered in the BBC film called A Century of the Self, which I think you have put in the Record Media at one point, and of course, in Bernays' book on propaganda. He puts it in a way so eloquently that I could never do. Guess it helps to have a PhD in linguistics. Anyway, it's pretty interesting. Thank you very much, Jory, or however you sell your name. You got a J in there. I'm not too sure how that exactly happens, but thank you very much. And what's important here is that when I find little audio clips like that are as important as that one there, I like to make sure it gets put on the show so that as you listen to my mindless diatribes, eventually you'll get something of quality at the beginning, at the end of the program, and that makes, well, everything better because we all just get a little bit more clever. And we have feedback, which I've been appreciating. There's been a lot of feedback coming in lately. I like it a lot. Hello, Sean and Sim, if you're not too busy. No, he's too busy. Screw you, hippie. On a recent newsreel, you discussed your fears about electronic brain implants. Whilst I can understand your fears when projecting possible future of fanciful misuse, I thought you might want my anecdotal story. My stepmother is one of those 70,000 people worldwide who has one of these devices. She's had the procedure done in a way to help progressing Parkinson's. The difference this treatment has made in her life has been amazing. 90% of the traumas she suffered, as well as sleeping pains, are now gone. She's also been able to drastically reduce the amount of medication she requires. The only noticeable side effect has been a slight slurring of her speech. This hope has given both her and my father for the extended life they've been able to enjoy together has been impossible to quantify. Yeah, I mean, like, well, what's better than that? Not everyone has had the procedure, has had the same amount of success, but of all the others that she has met with positive results. Sometimes things really are what they seem, and not a step towards our inevitable machine-ruled future of slavery and misery. X-Waster. Absolutely! First of all, really happy that technology was there for you. I'm a big fan of tech. Never mistake me for a Luddite. No. Ghost in the Shell fan right here. What I'm concerned about is the misuse of this technology. We all knew this technology is coming. We all know that. I am an optimist. I believe that the WOGs out there will be, if we're properly educated and we understand what we're watching out for, you know, you'll be able to tell what booby traps are if you know what a tripwire looks like. And that's sort of what I try to indicate to everybody is by letting them know what some possible bad things could happen. And occasionally, this, once you start to look at things a certain way, you see that make sure that, you know, because with this knowledge of the future comes a great amount of responsibility. We have to make sure that these tools get used as this has been used to help your grandmother, you know, have quality of life. I mean, absolutely. You betcha. Sign me up for carving on. You know, I think it's fantastic. But it's good to think about these things so that we understand how it could be misused or how, you know, this could be corrupted. Technology in of itself, and no matter what the procedure is not inherently good or evil. It's just a procedure. It's a tool. It all depends on how we use that tool, and that's what I'm actually concerned about. So really happy that, you know, hey, we live in a day and age where you were able to have that life extension. I think it's great. Dear Sean, regarding your comments in episode 493 about the chronically truant students having to carry GPS trackers and confirm their locations, which would be easy enough to spoof by giving them Confederates who were where they were supposed to be. I see what you're saying. So you just hand them off to a buddy and get him to punch it in. This actually does seem to help condition students as to the rigor of core political life. It is not uncommon these days for corporate employees to be issued laptop computers and cell phones so they'd be contacted for official businesses at all hours of the day and night. Absolutely. Whatever gods you believe in help you if your boss sends you an email that goes through to your work BlackBerry and you do not answer it within a few minutes, resulting in the dreaded, "Bob, we need to talk about your restructuring your personal time and be more accessible to the company" discussion with the people who sign the paychecks. There are some companies out there which insist that business comes first as well and have made people cancel flights while standing in airline terminals because some phone calls simply cannot be postponed. I could go into some outfits who veto powers over their employees' day off. Bob, we think going on vacation to Bermuda would make you less accessible to us if something came up. We will approve the vacation only to stay within CONUS, but I think you get my point. It seems that given the way things are going, major life decisions that everyone have to make, whether it's to take jobs, let us learn comfortably, or jobs that do pay well and less fulfilling, that allow for more personal autonomy. Hopefully, we'll be able to force a third option of that independent work as consultants and contractors rather than corporate citizens. Wait for that term to start showing up in the news. Corporate citizens. Yes. Sent in by the doctor. Yeah, it's kind of a crazy world we're heading towards. I mean, the days and age in North America of somebody being able to actually, you know, have a single-income family where mom stays home and look after the kids, that's gone. That's history. That's, you know, the whole nuclear family model that never existed. Well, it never existed in the first place. I guess for the golden generation, they could do it. You know, and maybe, I guess it did all right, but now, you know, we got big box daycare moving in from Australia, and, you know, there's some issues here. So, not to be negative, I think that, you know, as WOGs, we're able to sort this out, we're able to carry on forwards and make the world a better place, but we definitely got to be aware of exactly this kind of thing. You know, you should be getting up with some kind of a plan to make a little bit of money for yourself, or better yet, what I think is to discover what it is that you want or what you don't want. And I've talked to a lot of people. A lot of people tell me, Sean, I don't know what to do with my life. I get emails like that. I'm not even joking. And usually my response, which I've gotten from a lot of books, is it's almost as valuable if you don't know what you want to do as to know what you don't want to do. Like, if you don't want to be trapped behind a cubicle your whole life, well, maybe that's, you know, maybe you don't want to be trapped in a cubicle, so you eliminate all those jobs. Hey, Sean, I don't want to work in a puddles and rain all my life. I want to work indoors. Okay. Well, now by process of elimination, you can start pointing yourself towards something like, you know, you might enjoy to do. Think about if you won the lottery. You know, after you did all the traveling, what would you do with your spare time? Try to find a job that gives you that, you know? But at the end of the day, I mean, of course, we all have to consider money, which is why we all go to work. We go to work to make money so we can do things that we enjoy. So sometimes that balance gets a little bit screwed up. Now, of course, we have the distractions of modern media, which brings us to our first story in the news, which is probably one of the most... I've got some crazy cyberpunk stories this week, guys. Holy cow. In Videodrome News, movie you need to see. If you haven't seen it, go watch it. At a time when theaters are plagued by mindless movies, it's a twist worthy of Hitchcock. Films that are scripted, cast, edited, and marketed based on scans of viewers' brains. Science is getting ever closer to reading the audience's minds thanks to the emergence of neurocinema firms that use cognitive feedback to maximize engagement on what's on the screen. Using everything from functional magnetic resonance imaging to electroencephalography, these professional brain whisperers offer studios a peek into a person's deep subconscious response to entertainment with the ultimate goal of flop-proofing movies. We propose to use science, all the way from the scripts to testing, to edit through advertising. to editing and through to advertising, says A.K. Pradeep of the CEO of Neurofocus. The neuroscientific testing firm, which has offices around the world, is a growing number of laboratories in which brain feedback is used to gauge viewer responsiveness. EEG headsets, for instance, measure the brainwave scale at 2,000 times a second, allowing Pradeep's team to identify precise moments in which people are most stimulated by what's on the screen. Now, you'll notice here that the content isn't really relevant. Okay, what's in the movie isn't relative. They're now taking this technology of, you know, image and light and sound and seeing how they can alter your brain through your optic nerve to, you know, program you. That is exactly what they're doing here. They want to make sure that they can sell a concept. They want to make sure that they want to be able to control what we say next time, so that if we say, "May the Force be with you," you know, they want to make sure that they can say, "Hey, have this beverage here. And a smile." You know, why not? That's big bucks, right? Give people keys to your brain. It's getting harder and harder, I find. And maybe there's a lot of people out there who are like me. Is you just can't seem to get into movies anymore. Same with television. If you stop watching it for a while, you really don't miss it. And then if you try to get back into it, you start watching these shows and you wind up going, "Man, why am I wasting my time with this? You know, why am I doing that? This is crazy. Like, this is just simply not something that I want to waste my time with." And that's the problem. And I've seen this coming for a while, where they're going to start using, you know, essentially programming techniques and hardcore psyop operations, just like in the, you know, they're talking about in the clip. You know, this is where it's at. And this is why, you know, as a gag, I'm talking in patrolling. We're talking about, you know, wearing yellow lenses and stuff like that to offset colors so that the color spectrums, because it doesn't take much to distort this. Right, they put all this money into the exact shades to hit you with, and well, if you're listening to your own headphones and got your own little shades on, I guess you kind of defeat all that multi-million dollars of psyop propaganda they got on the go. You know, I mean, how long before we're actually going to need to start putting our heads inside of Faraday cages? I don't know. It's kind of a freaky deal. Little bit concerning, I think. Little bit concerning. Not as concerning. You know, I wonder sometimes with these, like the neuroscience guys. I mean, they're smart guys. I guess they've gone full mercenary. I guess they've gone full Blackwater, where they're like, "Yeah, whatever, man. I'll build you whatever you want. You want something that, you know, takes people's brains out? Absolutely. Absolutely. I'll build you that. I'll build you that. I'll build you something that'll just, you know, freak people out all over the world." You know, why not? But then you run into stories like this with the Bottweilers. Those of us who used to play Rifts will be well aware of the Bottweiler. These are robot dogs. And from the role-playing game Rifts. If you don't know what role-playing games are, go to your nearest used bookstore, go find yourself a copy of book one of Rifts, sit down and read it. It's probably the best writing tool ever in the history of the world. But anyway, role-playing games in general, not specifically that game. But in this game, there was a series of different robots and a bunch of cool stuff. One of them was the robot dogs that were used by the Coalition forces to run down enhanced bad guys. Very After Now-y kind of stuff. But Bottweilers are essentially robot hunter killers. Now, you would think this is, of course, now when this game came out, it was like the, you know, late 80s, early 90s. This was far-flung future stuff. We're getting close to, Doctor Who TARDIS kind of time travel sort of technology with this kind of a thing. But no. Now it seems that I'm going to report to you a story about doing exactly this. Like, what? Okay, DARPA has awarded a contract to create a cheetah robot that is faster than the fastest human alive. On Friday, Boston Dynamics, these are the guys with the mule, have announced that the United States DARPA has awarded them a contract to build a new four-legged robot that will be fast enough to chase, evade, and even hunt down the fastest human. The robot, rightfully named Cheetah, is designed to look very much like a real cheetah, with four legs and a flexible spine, tail, and an articulated head. Boston Dynamics promises that the cheetah bot will be faster than even the fastest human, will also have the agility to make tight turns and stop immediately. The company hopes to design the robot so it could run zigzags to efficiently chase and evade. Aside from the slightly terrifying applications that would come from adding some teeth to the cheetah bot, Boston Dynamics sees their creation as riding to the rescue of wounded soldiers, emergency response, firefighting, advanced agriculture, and vehicular travel. No information was given on how much money these cheetah bots will cost or when they'll be ready, but we'll keep our eyes out for any human-hunting robo-cheetahs going viral. Well, you know, that's kind of like right out of Snow Crash, like right there. You know, all we got to do is get them this robot body, and then we'll hook up some sort of, like, rat brain to it, give it a good bloodlust, get it addicted to a drug like Nuke, and have it work for drugs. That'll be awesome, you know. I think it's cool. What I'm waiting for, though, is I'm waiting for the hack-a-day version, you know, like, build your own. Because you know somebody's going to be waiting for this thing to be left alone for 20 minutes. They'll rip in there, tear it down, copy all the code, and put it out there so I can have my very own, you know, Ranger Mark II. Hey! He's got some crunch. Awesome. We start building our own pets. I mean, honestly, even if you were to get one of these things, I would just cover it with fake fur and, like, make the scariest Muppet ever. You know, don't even try, like, because the Uncanny Valley at that place. I'm here to tell you, if I opened a robotics company, that's what I'd call it. It would be Uncanny Valley Robotics. And I would make the creepiest goddamn robots ever. Like the doll's head with the spider legs from Toy Story. Absolutely. Absolutely. We will sell those in crates. It'll be awesome. You know, I guess this is where we're at. This is the day and age when we have actual government contracts being awarded for human hunting robot canine cheetah cats. Boy, oh boy. I would like to see what this is going to look like, because other than the fact that it's a lot of vaporware right now, it's pretty loud. The current stuff, although it's impressive, is not really what I would call intimidating. Now, something that is intimidating is this new TSA DNA scanning news. The Transportation Security Agency is no stranger to controversy. It is the same guys who are nuking you at the airports and whatnot, giving you a nice feel down. The TSA has been subject to the much scrutiny from civil libertarians and constitutionalists who have criticized the agency's numerous affronts against the natural rights of American and foreign travelers. They have been subjected to violations to their bodily integrity and their right to property. The latest, most controversial move undertaken by the TSA, the agency announced that it would now be scanning and inspecting individual travelers' genetic information, effectively documenting and storing copies of individual DNA codes. Want to get on a plane? Give me your DNA. The agency already utilizes a number of invasive procedures on travelers, violating of bodily autonomy, such as groping passengers, most intimate body parts, and humiliating the infirmed and disabled through such moves as confiscating disabled boys' leg braces, damaging a bladder cancer survivor's urostomy bag. The intended program of roving genetic scanning will be conducted in partnership between the TSA and who else but the Department of Homeland Security, and represents a significant step towards the creation of a government-managed database of every American citizen's genetic information, known as the National DNA Database, which will be compiled as individuals pass through both genetic and body scanners, and as they pass through airport checkpoints. Good place to get them. Get them in the checkpoints. The TSA's announcement, well, it will pursue genetic scanning, has been described by critics as amounting to a genetic pat-down, referring to the pat-down procedures already used by TSA agents on travelers' body parts. It is not enough that government is currently involuntarily taking body scans of travelers, using X-ray technology to take and document individuals' bodies. They are now also involuntarily taking scans of individuals' genes. According to Dr. Richard Selinen, the executive director of Networks Biosystems, the biotechnology firm granted an exclusive government contract to develop the genetic scanning technology. This can be done in real time with no technical expertise. DNA frame information has the potential to become part of the fabric of day-to-day life, and this facilitates that process. Well, sign me up. Wouldn't that be great? As vocal proponent of portable genetic scanning, Selden also claims the device can be tailored for use in emergency room, food safety tests, law enforcement settings, and even for federal agency hiring practices, and anticipates the commercializations of this device within a year. Well, what this does is it does make it like, okay, so how about this? How about we gate off Washington? Everyone with a criminal record is no longer allowed there. Ta-da! Oh, it's a database. It's like the no travel list. There's these gates get put up everywhere, and if they have your DNA, you're not getting through the gate. You have a warrant against you, you're not getting through the gate. If you're going into a movie theater, oh, are you guilty of movie piracy charges? Well, the MPAA's put you on this list. They don't want you watching their films. You're not getting through the gate. The ability to control people by individual fingerprinting like this is truly frightening. It's truly frightening. I don't even see how is this preventing terrorism by creating genetic databases? I don't even understand why they're, why not do it at the mall? You know, it's about as relevant to going shopping as it is going flying. There's absolutely no reason for this. But this is where we are headed. So, you know, this is why, you know, we cover the stories that we do, and we try to drive this to everyone's attention, so at least you're informed. At least you're informed. Walking forward. Now, as, of course, technology progresses, and ethics don't really, you know, come along, we have the small boiling pot effect, you know, the frog in the pot. Water slowly gets warmer, the frog won't jump out. Well, now, you know, this is one of those beginning bubbling kind of pots right here. This next story, which I call replicant news, because if this isn't really a replicant, I don't really know what is. And I'd like to really get some vocal people focused on this kind of a thing. In an experiment that sounds more like fiction than reality, U.S. researchers have engineered a hybrid organism that's part insect, part machine. This is what Pat Scheel writes. There's nothing new about remote-controlled aircraft. The earliest ones date to World War I, and with the development of the transistor became possible to make radio receivers and control systems small enough to fit into model planes and helicopters you see buzzing around in parks, followed by gleeful geeks and handheld transmitters. But trying to get much smaller, engineers have come up with the problems of scale that have recently proved intractable. To get things down to size of a large insect, for example, you need to have an engine to drive the aircraft, a radio on board, control system steerers, and a source of energy to make it all function. If you want to build a plane the size of a beetle, it's just about impossible because the batteries, engines, and electronics are far too heavy from the lift from ground from the wings so small. But in a breakthrough that is both creepy and as it is ingenious, engineers and scientists have managed to get around many of these problems by using off-the-shelf technology that's cheap, efficient, and proven over many years in all manner of environments in real, live insects. From an engineering standpoint, it makes perfect sense. Bugs become ready equipped with their own engine and sophisticated navigation system. They simply eat to refuel, and millions of years of evolution have turned insects into efficient flying machines. All that is needed is a way to override their own navigation systems that a human pilot can send them any direction the critter's natural flight range. Flying machines? Sure that this is a living animal, not a machine. Well, actually, it's hard to say. Welcome to the rapidly blurring distinction between electronic engineering and animal husbandry. Several groups in the United States have been working on controlled insect flight research, funded by your friends and mine, DARPA, through its Hybrid Insect Microelectric Mechanical Systems Project, HIMEMS Project. Now, there's something I bet you didn't know about. This is really, really good, which is aimed to create a hybrid cybernetic organisms. That's what its aim is, to create hybrid cybernetic organisms. Well, shit, sign me up. One of the most successful is headed by an associate professor of electrical engineering at the University of California, Berkeley, Michael Maharbitz. Maharbitz's team have reached the point where they can remotely control a beetle. They settled on the heavy lift 5-centimeter Mecharinth tortaga to take off, turn right, turn left, and land. They are working on finer controls that will much more complex flight paths in three dimensions. I don't know why they're wasting their time with that. I'd go get me some, like, a bird spider or a baboon spider or something like that. You know, something that you would just, you know, terrify the... Go get some wind scorpions, some camel spiders. Get those bad boys in there. Yeah, you know. I've oftentimes thought that I'd really like to open a baboon farm. You know, why not? I could just raise baboons and treat them like police dogs. And that way you'd have, like, instead of a canine team, you'd have baboon teams. you know, and nobody, and they could carry a bat. You know, really? And how much genetic tinkering would it really, really take to make them just a little bit smarter? Just a touch. You know, you move to Somalia, some country down there, we get baboons in cheap, start messing around with the genetics a bit, and bam! You got yourself some smart club-wheeling baboons. Hell yeah! Treat them halfway decent, make sure they get UFC, give them some cable, teach them how to play Xbox. You got baboon-wielding, you know, clan monkeys. It's an excellent idea. It's an excellent idea, you know, and there's really not a lot of forces out there that could stop a man with a good army of slightly uplifted monkeys, really, you know. And so I applaud this particular project. I think it's kind of neat. How do researchers make the connection from the transmitters to the beetles so they can receive their instructions? It's delicate business, done by hand, one bug at a time. Beeswax is used to hold the anesthetized beetles in place, while small holes are pierced in the cuticle in the head underneath the wings. What does this remind me of, like a UFO abduction? I got stuck to a table, they put holes in my head. Steel wire electrodes already soldered to an electronic control board are then threaded through the holes to the required depth in the brain of the beetle. The board, including a tiny computer that runs controlled software, radio receiver, an antenna, and a battery, is strapped to the back of the beetle like a backpack, and the bug is ready to be flown. Wow, I really hope, you know, that beetles never evolve and, you know, get the upper hand on us humans, because if they do and this kind of information gets out, we're going to really suffer under the reign of the bugs. A member of Haimem's team, Hiroto Sato, established that Mercurino rhino beetles could be switched on and off. I can turn them on and off once. By applying repeated positive and negative voltage pulses to electrodes implanted between the left and right optic lobes of the insect's brain that string varying numbers of these flight intuition pulses, allowing him to control the vertical tilt of the beetle's flight and thus control the altitude. For left, right controls, he turned to the muscles. Direct stimulation to the basilar muscle found underneath the wing for low-frequency electric pulses acted as basic turning commands. So you get the point here. What they're doing is they're wiring these bugs up to be able to fly around as, you know, insects on a wire. Now, it's just bugs, right? They're just bugs, right? But, you know, where's this going to go? Why not do it with monkeys? Hey, come on. Nobody, and if you, and I'm not the first guy thinking about this. There's got to be more and more people who are considering, you know, these kind of applications. Technology is there. Technology is there. Think about all the animals, and if you could uplift and control, pretty interesting stuff. Pretty interesting stuff. And, of course, we're, of course, at a genetic engineering state that if we figure out where what bugs are easier to control, like insects breed really, really quickly. I've oftentimes thought about this, you know, like what could you do if you could, like, breed up a bunch of these spiders and stuff and hook them all up, make, like, you know, a security company where what you do is you go get yourself a bunch of, say, oh, I don't know, camel spiders. So you breed up these camel spiders and you dye them all black and you train them using the little electrodes that, you know, it'll patrol an area. So if you pull up to a site, somebody's broken in, you throw 20 spiders through the window, you either wait to hear the screaming or in 10 minutes all the little explosive backpacks on the spiders go off, killing them instantly. Great! What could possibly go wrong? You know, little cybernetic attack spiders that you sick on people. You can call yourself Terradrome Security. It has a nice ring to it, you know? Anyway, I just, yeah, it's $1 million ideas here on Newsreel. Because, you know, we're just ahead of the curve over here. You just wait a couple of years. Now, of course, the cyber police. We've all been concerned about the cyber police, but check this out. This is a pretty draconian little law that I picked up just the other day. In cyber police news, officers from the Thames Valley Police will send a message to in a trial in the first scheme of its kind to be launched on Monday. The police will be joined by teenage volunteers to identify school-aged Facebook bullies who are harassing fellow students. This is amazing to me. The bullies will be told that their actions are breaking the law and they could face persecution. Prosecution, which is essentially persecution. The aggressor's parents will be told their child is an online bully and what their consequences could be. The scheme designers hope is that the direct action will cut the number of the people harassed over the internet. This is incredible. This is incredible. I was bullied when I was in high school, absolutely. Like, that's just, you know, that's one of those things that happened in some people's lives. And now, I mean, you know, after, you know, Cletus and Diebold there shot up the school, everybody takes bullying a little bit more seriously because, you know, they started shooting people. And now suddenly it's turned into this, where you can rat out on to the cops if somebody's saying bad stuff about you online. Is this a good thing? I don't know. It's an interesting sort of way to bring in a lot of ideas. I'm not really too sure I am how happy I'd be. I think there's a better use of the cops' time, to be really honest with you. I suppose, what other enforcement can there be? If this isn't the realm of the police officers, whose realm does it fall into? Several suicides, particularly among teenagers, have been blamed on internet bullies in recent years. Dave Thomas, who devised the scheme, will be initial monitor to school's reading area, said, but by sending a police warning notice on Facebook, students will be made aware that they could be prosecuted. We're aiming to nip the problem in the bud to prevent it from becoming something more serious. Interesting. So cops, you know, monitoring comms and responding to people getting ratted out. This could be abused. I mean, you could see that, you know, it's a good way to wind people to get this onto, you know, no-fly lists. Good way to get names for that. And when you combine that sort of technology with the ideas of what you got going on in England, where they're doing, you know, pre-crime and they're scanning people for genetic keys on what makes them future criminals, you know, you could work in Unity and come up with a really good sort of filter to catch anyone who is, quote-unquote, undesirable. Now, Orfet sent in this piece of knowledge, which is interesting. Some illegal knowledge news. Interesting story. For years, Electronic Frontier Foundation has been warning about the anti-circumvention provisions of the Digital Millennium Copyright Act can be used to chill speech, particularly in security research, because legitimate researchers will be afraid to publish their results lest they be accused of circumventing technology protection measure. We've also been concerned that the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act could be abused to try to make alleged contract violations into crimes. We've never been sorrier to be right. These two things are precisely what has happened in Sony versus HOTS. If you've missed that one, Sony has sued several security researchers for publishing information about security holes in Sony's PlayStation 3. At first glance, it's hard to see why Sony's bothering. After all, the research was presented 3 weeks ago at the Chaos Communications Congress and properly circulated around the world. The security flaws discovered by the researchers allow users to run Linux on their machines again, something Sony used to support but recently started trying to prevent, paying lawyers to try to put the cat back in the bag by just throwing good money after bad. Even if they won, we'll save the legal analysis for another post. The defendants seem unlikely to be able to pay the significant damages, so what's the point? The real point, as it appears, is send a message to security researchers around the world. Publish the details of our security flaws, and we'll come after you with both barrels blazing. For example, Sony has asked the court to immediately impound all circumvention devices, which it defines to include not only the defendant's computers, but also all instructions, i.e. their research and findings. Given the research results, Sony presumably cares about are available online. Granting an order would mean that everyone except the researchers themselves would have access to their work. Not content with the DMCA hammer, Sony is also bringing a slew of outrageous Computer Fraud and Abuse Act claims. The basic gist of Sony's argument is researchers assessing their own PlayStation 3 consoles in a way that violated the agreement that Sony imposes on users of the network. Now, in After Now, I talk about this very thing, where people were turned into criminals because they altered their own electronic devices, where they would take something that they purchased, brought it home, broke it open, and began to alter the parts inside. You know, and suddenly this is somehow illegal. You bought this item, you paid somebody money, you take it, but it's not yours. You just kind of licensed it. This is ridiculous. These kind of, ideas are just absolutely retarded. I don't understand why we accept this. You know, if I go into a store and I purchase something, it's mine now. Okay? That's kind of how that works. Could you imagine trying to, like, pass this off in some country where they didn't have... Like, imagine trying to explain this to somebody in Africa and how this actually works. I mean, there'd be no... It would be called a scam. It's totally nuts. Yet we seem to accept it. There seems to be no end. You know, as long as it's introduced to us slowly, we'll accept it. Now, this is an interesting story here. Some conspiracy news, which, you know, I'm not one to start throwing rocks at people who are pretty great. And let's be really straight. Alex Jones is pretty great. I like Alex Jones a lot. But Fat Ninja sent in this story, and I thought it was interesting. Because this, if anything else, made me think that maybe Alex Jones was close to the truth. This might be it, because now it seems like mainstream media is attacking Alex Jones, which, you know, I mean, he's pretty extreme, so I don't know why they'd be doing that, but that's exactly what they're doing. A new Rolling Stone magazine article written about talk show host Alex Jones, set to be published this month, reveals how he's been heavily influenced by the John Birch Society. Before we get into some quotes from the article, here's a quick primer on what the many questions surrounding the credibility of this organization. The John Birch Society is essentially a controlled opposition front group that was started by people tied in with globalist institutions, including the Council on Foreign Relations, Federal Reserve, and the Internal Revenue Service. The late author and researcher Eustace Mullins, who was the first to expose the fraud and criminal nature of the Federal Reserve, stated on several occasions that the John Birch Society is actually started by the money of the Rockefeller family, who, of course, have been major promoters of globalist ideologies. Robert Welch, who is the primary founder of the John Birch Society, was sympathetic of the National Association of Manufacturers, which has historically promoted fascism. The political stances of the John Birch Society on the attacks of 9/11 and the phony terror wars have always been at lockstep with the establishment mainstream rhetoric, which raises even more questions. The long-term promotion of anti-communist rhetoric throughout the Cold War was used to give credibility to the fake communist threat that would enable the expansion of the military-industrial complex, which is now being used to push ahead the New World Order agenda in a big way. There are also many questions about early John Birch Society members and their links to secret societies of the Freemasons. Here are some quotes from the Rolling Stone article and outlining the influence the controlled opposition John Birch Society has had and still to this day has on Jones. Home life was intellectual, but not overly political. My parents were careful not to give me political views as an experiment to see of what I turn into, he says. The closest thing to childhood political training was some neighbors who were members of the John Birch Society. They'd come over for dinner, and I'd be exposed to those ideas starting around age 2. The most enduring influence, though, was the 1971 bestseller he found on his father's bookshelf, None Dare Call It Conspiracy, authored by Gary Allen, a spokesman for the John Birch Society. The book provided the cornerstone of the New World Order conspiracies. According to None Dare, the federal income tax is nothing but a plot by a cabal of mega-rich insiders who work to suck the middle class dry and transfer its wealth to the Ford and Rockefeller foundations. As a teenager, Jones read the book twice. It's still the easiest-to-read primer on the New World Order, he says. Jones has even had John McManus, the Jesuit-trained leader of the John Birch Society, in studio for an interview on his radio show, which ended with McManus mentioning how he hopes that their relationship with the Jones would continue. This, of course, indicated a previously existing relationship with Jones and had with the John Birch Society. It is these ties that Jones has and continues to have with the John Birch Society that should raise a number of questions about his credibility. Dun, dun, dun! So, I guess, they're turning on Alex Jones. You know, everyone's spinning around on him. You're not... Okay, this is the guy who built the truth movement, the 9/11 truth movement. This guy has been pretty much the lion of the whole thing, and now somebody's able to throw rocks at him. What a great idea. Now, whether or not he's a member of this society, I have a hard time believing for half a second that anybody who's connected with the New World Order is funding Alex Jones. I'd like to see how that gets sold, because I'm sorry, it seems to me kind of an open and shut case. I mean, Alex Jones is, he's kind of done more damage than, I'm pretty sure that if they could shut him down, they would. So very interesting article there. And I wonder if that means anything that they're trying to discredit Alex now. You know, does that even give him more credibility? I'm not too sure. But definitely something to think about. And we got a little bit of human experimentation news. Get it? Inhuman experimentation? Inhuman experimentation? Okay, anyway. As shocking as it may seem, now this is something that's just become available, but this is a, you know, as you've probably picked up with every single one of these wars that we've been involved in the last little while, they're all based on a lie. So history keeps repeating itself because they're going to go with the ideas that work. So knowing that, moving forwards, shocking as it may seem, U.S. government doctors once thought it was fine to experiment on disabled people and prison inmates. Such experiments included giving hepatitis to mental patients in Connecticut, squirting pandemic flu and viruses up the noses of prisoners in Maryland, injecting cancer cells into chronically ill people at a New York hospital. Much of this horrific history is 40 to 80 years old. 40 years ago is not that long ago. But it's the backdrop for a meeting in Washington this week by Presidential Bioethics Commission. The meeting was triggered by the government's apology last fall for federal doctors infecting prisoners and mental patients in Guatemala with syphilis 65 years ago. The U.S. officials also acknowledge there have been dozens of similar projects, experiments in the United States. Studies often involve making healthy people sick. Now, this is still going on. Of course, they're going to do it in third world nations. They're going to do it in Africa. They're going to do it in all these places where, you know, no one can really strike back. But they're getting this research done so that they can, you know, move ahead. And it's worth big dollars. In an exhaustive review by the Associated Press of medical journal reports and decades-old press clippings found more than 40 such studies. At best, these were a search for life-saving treatments. At worst, some amounted to curiosity-satisfying experiments that hurt people but provided no useful results. Inevitably, they would be compared to the well-known Tuskegee syphilis study. In that episode, U.S. health officials tracked 600 black men in Alabama who already had syphilis, but didn't give them adequate treatment or even penicillin when it became available. These studies were worse in at least one respect. They violated the concept of first do no harm, a fundamental medical principle that stretches back centuries. Well, interesting. Isn't that interesting? Well, you know, ethics or so. Nobody has ethics anymore. Come on, we're all worshiping the dollar, right? That's what everybody's kind of moving towards. When you give somebody a disease, even by the standards of their time, you really cross the key ethical norm of the profession, says Arthur Claflin, director of the University of Pennsylvania Center for Bioethics. Some of these studies, mostly from the 1940s to the 60s, apparently were never covered by news media. Oh, you think? Others were reported at the time, but the focus was on the promise of enduring new cures, while glossing over how the test tub subjects were treated. Attitudes about medical research were different then. Infectious diseases killed many more people years ago, and doctors worked urgently to invent test cures. Many prominent researchers felt it was legitimate to experiment on people who did not have full rights in societies, people like prisoners, mental patients, poor blacks. It was an attitude some way similar to that the Nazi doctors experimenting on Jews. There was definitely a sense that we don't have today, that sacrifice for the nation was important. Well, yeah, we don't have that today. Now it's sacrifice for the dollar. Okay? For the dollar. That's what they're sacrificing themselves for. It's for the buck. This is what Laura Stark, Wesleyan University assistant professor of science and society, who's writing the book about the past federal medical experiments. Very interesting stuff. Very interesting stuff. Of course, there was LSD, you know, mind programming experiments. There was all kinds of, you know, mental stuff that was done with MKUltra that gets glossed over. I mean, there's a case where they took one woman, fed her so much acid, they knocked her out, fed her mega doses of acid and hooked her up to electroshock therapy, and kept pumping voltage through her and basically formatted her head. Now, riddle me this. Let's say I go win me the lottery next week, and I'm going to move somewhere where I don't get a lot of laws. All right, so I've got free reign. Now I'm going to open a rehabilitation camp. And what I do is I take people in who are like, you know, total junky, broken crackheads. Okay, people who are completely and totally cracked out, no hope. You know the ones I mean. These are the ones running around, no teeth, totally like freaked out. All right. Now I take these ones and I do this whole procedure on them. Where you take them in medically, you know, if they're so physically far gone that you can't repair them, like it's impossible to repair them. I mean, you would do the best you can, you know, or I suppose you would be able to take in everybody, but the people who are pretty, you'd have to be really, really far gone. Like, we're talking massive burned holes in your brain in order not to make this. So that's a pretty low amount of people you absolutely couldn't do this to. But if you were to bring them in there, you know, you kind of format, reinstall, start at the beginning, have like a 2-year program where you build these people up into, you know, the Rudyard Kipling sort of approach. Maybe not something not quite so imperial, but you were to, like, you know, completely reinstill a new personality. Is that ethical? Is that ethical to do that? I mean, these people are dying, they're destroying themselves. I often wonder about that. You've got a viewpoint on that, you know? And you can see what the conundrum there is, of course, because, you know, you're taking these people and you're formatting and reinstalling people. Is that a good idea? I mean, they're going to die. Are you actually helping people, or what are you doing there? Very interesting. Very interesting. So I'm always interested in different viewpoints on that. Newsreel, antrantradio.com. Got some Cyberpunk kit here. This one's kind of neat. There's no word on pricing yet, but color night vision. Thank you very much, Fat Ninja, again. This is very cool. The Nano System Research Division of AIST, National Institute of Advanced Industrial Science and Technology in Japan, recently showed off a new camera that's capable of taking color photos in the dark. It makes use of highly sensitive infrared technology that allows it to capture real-time colored video in darkness using advanced algorithms to analyze reflected wavelengths from objects in different colors. The camera is able to fill the images with colors instead of the usual monochrome color green we've come to expect from night vision cameras. The camera is still in the development stage, but there are plans to turn it into commercial device for sale to the public by the end of 2011. First, they have to scale it down and make it durable for everyday use. No word on price. But watch a video of the camera of it in action. So it actually does work. They do have a prototype. This isn't total vaporware. Pretty interesting stuff. Today's daily hack. This one is kind of neat. Stenography is the process of hiding an encrypted message in some otherwise innocent-looking format. Very cool. And what they've done here is they've taken some hidden encryption and they've hidden it inside of video. Very, very interesting. We've gone over some ways to do this in the past with image files, but now you can take it to a whole new level by hiding an entire TrueCrypt volume in an MP4 video file. Very, very interesting stuff. Because after all, you know, it's handy to be able to, you know, sometimes communicate that way, just for your own personal amusement. And that's all I got for you today, but don't worry, I'll be back next week to make sure you get the news you need to survive. This has been a free podcast brought to you by the Wogs Who Care. If you cannot donate to this program, please distribute the program. Please make sure you give the program to someone who you think might like it. Drop it off at the local comic shop. Hang out with people who, you know, might, you know, be interested in what's going on next time you go to a show. Say, hey, you should check this out. You might dig it. As well, if you can donate, swing by the Dark Atlas website, pick up some swag, always nice, or you can send a disguised envelope to Rant Media Studios, Box 95089, 37 East Broadway, Vancouver, BC, Canada, V5T1W0. And of course, as for always, I want to thank my army, the army that I'm a part of. They're not mine personally, I'm just another fucking monkey, just like Starling, just another fucking monkey, in the army of the Flying Monkeys for their assistance in gathering data. It's great to be, you know, part of that army. If you have information you'd like to send me, you can reach me at newsreel@randradio.com. And be sure to sign up for the Rant newsletter by sending an email to the great and powerful Sim, located at info@randradio.com. If you like the music in the background, make sure you check out some Psytrance. And I'm going to fade out now with one of the tracks from my own personal collection. I'm sure you'll love it. Remember, everyone, we will never defeat the enemy if we are at each other's throats. So until next time, that's what Server said. End of line.